Congratulations on running this fantastic project here in wonderful Bristol. As you say, I'm a local boy, very good I am. So I'm slightly going, I'm going quite a bit off script, I'm afraid, so apologies for that, because I have forsworn metaphysics for the time being while I finish off and a book that has just been completed, so just to give a bit of background, so it really is just being finished off and has two defining features. One is it's virulently anti-empiricist, and the other aspect is that it's promoting a sort of knowledge-first epistemology of science. So I'm afraid to say it's epistemology rather than metaphysics, but it is going to be meta-scientific, so in the sense that I'm asking whether is meta-scientific knowledge. The other ways in which I'm going sort of off script, I'm afraid, is that I'm going to be saying there isn't much meta-scientific knowledge to be had. Certainly not global meta-scientific knowledge. And that's because one of the principal reasons is because there isn't any methodological unity of science. Okay, so really these famous arguments, the no miracles argument, the sort of pessimistic, the skeptical argument, and the pessimistic induction is a pessimistic, just a skeptical argument. The no miracles argument is an optimistic. So pro-science scientific knowledge argument, both of these are the sort of global meta-scientific arguments that aim to tell us something about science overall, and I don't think we can do that. I don't think there's anything that much to be done. I will tell you at the end that what the closest we can get to a sort of global meta-scientific argument is. The talk has three principal parts and then a lengthy conclusion. Just concluding. Most people hope that this talk will end then. It won't. So the first section will be on a sort of simple no miracles argument. The next section will be on the pessimistic meta-induction. The third section will be coming back to the no miracles argument in the sort of souped up form due to Richard Boyd and Stathis Tsilos. So let's go with the simple no miracles argument. This is probably what I was going to be saying. I've said this bit already. Okay, so here's the simple no miracles argument. And really what I'm going to be arguing here is truth and approximate truth are not explanatory. Well, that's not quite true. They are explanatory. But they're not. They don't give any. The truth of a proposition gives you no more explanatory power than the content of the proposition itself. So really, there isn't. What I'm going to be claiming is there isn't anything interesting, meta-scientifically interesting, to this this argument. Perhaps the easiest way to see that is to think about the no miracles argument as applied to a particular theory. Call it some theory A, or T of A, theory T of A with content A. We'd be saying, look, this theory has a high degree of empirical success, and that's best explained by the thought that it's true, or at least approximately true. I was going to say true, but you can add or approximately true if you prefer. What's that really saying? What I want to do is drill down to thinking about what's the content of this explanatory claim. We'll think about two things, an explanandum and an explanans. What are we trying to explain? So it's the empirical success of A. Well, what the empirical success of a theory is up to some debate, but it's going to be something like it makes some predictions, possibly retrodictions, but there are some things that we might observe, or at least discover in the world, and these will work with predictions, but you can expand that if you want. So a theory has made some predictions, and they've been
observed, otherwise discovered to be the case. So successful predictions. And I suppose, as it were, if you want to say what's the content of this success is not just the predictions, but the fact that they are predictions. We might work with a particular theory. So there's the famous Alvarez theory of the KET for us old-timers, or for you youngsters, KPG, extinction of the, that famous extinction. It's best explained by the truth of the Alvarez theory. That could be our example. Okay. So we've got theory, we're saying it's empirically successful, and that's explained by its truth. So what are the true observed predictions? In this case, going to be retrodictions of the theory. Well, one of the consequences of this theory is that you would expect to see an unusual amount or concentration of iridium in the geological layers where you find the extinction, because meteors are unusually rich in iridium relative to the Earth's crust. So we'll take that as a prediction of the theory, and indeed, lo and behold, that's what we do find. That's the famous iridium anomaly. Okay. So that's a success of the theory, that it predicts or retrodicts this iridium anomaly. Okay. Let's think about the explanans. What's doing the explanation? It's the truth of the theory. Well, here's the question: is that truth explanatory? So what I do in the paper, and in the chapter of this book, and I'm not going to do now, is just go through your favourite and possibly unfavourite theories of truth, and ask with respect to each of them, does that theory of truth give the truth of a proposition some explanatory power? And look, here's a little example. You take the deflationary theory of truth. Deflationary theory of truth says the proposition A is true says no more than A itself. That's what the deflationary, in a nutshell, the deflationary theory says. So it makes abundantly clear, if you're a deflationist about truth, that the thought that A is true explains anything. Whatever it explains can be no more, or indeed no less, than what A itself explains. Okay. So in this sense, A is true is explanatory, but its explanatory power is no more than the proposition that is true itself. In fact, I think if you get to anti-realist theories of truth, you'll get arguably less explanatory power from A is true than you get from A itself. And that's going to be a moot point, but you're certainly not going to get any more. The correspondence theory, arguably, it's more rich. You might get more stuff coming out of the correspondence theory, but really, the additional stuff is... you've got to say, you've got the content of the proposition, you've got the world being as the proposition says, and some correspondence between the proposition and the world. But that doesn't add, you're thinking about it, what is explained by this meteor impact? Does that give you any additional stuff to, when you say, it's a proposition that there was this impact corresponds to the way the world is, explanatory power does that give you over and above the fact that there was this meteor impact, the content of the proposition or the theory itself? Okay, so we could talk about that, but what I go do in detail for all these accounts is say, we don't get more explanatory power from the complex proposition A is true than we get from A itself. So really, what this you know, miracles idea amounts to is simply saying that the evidence for some theory is best explained by the content of that theory. The truth. The empirical success of the Alvarez theory is best explained by its truth. Says no more nor less than something much like the following: the existence of the iridium layer is best explained by the meteor impact. So this version of the no miracles argument, I say, simply reduces to a repetition of the scientific claims made on behalf of each theory. You don't get anything else you didn't get beforehand. Okay, so I talked about a particular theory, but scaling up all of science, it doesn't make any difference. Science is just a big conjunction of all our favourite theories. Okay. So let's move on to the pessimistic meta-induction. So we all know what this says. Poincaré's express aside, it's not clear that he actually thought it was the case, although some contemporaries, there's some sense of pessimistic induction in Duhem points. But anyway, that's the famous argument. There's a number of things you can do. You can attack the inductive base for this argument, and I think that's a very sensible thing to do, although I won't say much more about that today, and then you can attack the inductive inference. And I think that there are various interesting ways of doing both of these things. I mean, it's really such a bad argument, and so much of modern philosophy of science is founded on this bad argument. Structural realism. Actually, the best argument for structural realism is to go on to structural realism and to use metaphysics. So we're in good company here. I find that the epistemic structural realism is founded on one or two case studies and then some wild generalisation from them. And I think the nicest argument on this attacking the inductive base, I'll mention briefly because it might come a little bit relevant to what I say later on, is Ludwig Feuerbach's argument from the exponential growth of science. So terms of scientific activity, output papers, your data, whichever measure you like to use, science grows exponentially. Roughly doubling every 20-something years. So, even taking the youngest of us here, half of all science is done in our lifetimes. And for some of us certainly rather more than half of all science. Whereas notably, all the examples of the pessimistic inductivists use come from that tiny sliver at the beginning of science. Of course, they look in terms of, the pessimistic inductivist looks in terms of time, right? But time isn't the relevant thing. What's important is the amount of science done. How successful, how long a theory has lasted as a piece of evidence for its being successful is not to be measured in years, but in terms of the amount of science done that you could refute it if the experiments turned out the right way. I mean, if there was a sort of Brexit causes a slowdown in science. If you wait, but well, I hope not, but it will be. The fact that the theory lasted twice as long because there's less science done to try and refute it doesn't mean it was more successful. But that would mean that you would expect the kinds of pessimistic refutations, successful theories eventually being refuted, to become more and more and more frequent over time. We should have seen zillions of refutations of hitherto successful theories in recent years, but that's not what we actually see.
So I think that's one of the good arguments on the inductive base. There are a bunch of arguments that attack the inductive inference. I just want to present one today. The way to get into this, I think, is to think of science as a sort of fallible, potentially fallible oracle. This is the way the pessimistic induction sort of treats science, because it says... You're thinking about science as look, science has been very successful, and therefore we should. But then it has these refutations, which show that even success is not a sign of truth. That way of looking at things, like, as it were, you would. Going to an oracle and say, you're an oracle, you walk to what you see into the future, or can you tell some stuff, give some true propositions, and the oracle gives us some propositions which you seem to be true, and then eventually we find them refuted, and then we have to think, well, perhaps this oracle wasn't so good after all. But I think this is a poor analogy. I mean, one reason is that it assumes an epistemic unity of science. If you were going to an oracle, you might think, well, this oracle is this one thing that's giving us these predictions or giving these propositions and tells us that we ought to believe. But I don't think that science is really like that. I mean, put it this way, it's certainly up for question whether it is. So if any kind of induction, whether simple numerative induction or Reichenbachian version of it, we know that you can't just stick any old predicate in place of F and G. I mean, the Grew paradox tells us we can't stick anything in place of G here. But the same true goes for the antecedent proposition F, although it's less frequently remarked upon. okay, so if we are going to make some induction on the history of science, it better be that there is some unity, methodological unity to science, such that its past failures are relevant evidence to its future failures. But that's certainly up for question whether that's the case. Right. Yeah. So, for example, just to get you thinking about this, imagine that science were a family resemblance concept or something like that. First of all, why might I think that? Well, one reason is the fact that different languages, the relevant term for science just includes or excludes different things. So typically, you start here, and when we use science in English, we do not include things like history as falling within the concept science, whereas if you're a German talking about Wissenschaft, then it would. Perhaps what's going on is that science is a concept that's is a family resemblance concept, and new things are new kinds of activity, different kinds of activity are brought within the concept according to their degree of resemblance to things already falling under the concept. In which case, as it were, you could imagine different languages might have a similar core, but some languages apply, as it were, the similarity requirement more strictly than others. But if this was right, then there wouldn't be one thing that characterises everything you want to call as science. And family resemblance concepts are not particularly good for doing induction. Okay, so I'm not saying that is my considered view, but it's, as it were, a reason for thinking, at least raising this question, what is science such that we can do induction on science? I think there's another reason why this oracle analogy is a poor one, although in the sense that PMI invites it, it's that it's
Incredible. That wasn't really good. Oh, and this is because...
But this is the feature that the PMI and the miracles argument seem to have, is that they're avoiding talking about the science itself. They say, look, it's successful, believe it. And rather assumes that all we've got to go on, as it were, in judging is like the oracle. You followed its predictions and claims, and even the ones that seem good at first, you're ultimately refuted. That's all we've got to go on. But we don't know how the oracle makes its predictions. Should we just get them? But scientists, you know, our relationship, particularly if we're philosophers of science, oughtn't be like that. You know, we do know. We do have access to science's reasons, so to speak, in the way that we don't have for the oracle's reason. We can read the scientific papers, and if we acquire enough expertise, we'll be able to make our own assessments about whether the arguments in those papers are any good or not. Imagine you went to the oracle, and the oracle says, "You believe me, this P is true." And then you would say to your oracle, "Well, why are you making that prediction?" And then the oracle starts to give you its reasons. And then you say, "Well, that's your reason, that's the sum total of my reasons for making it." Well, what do you now, at this point, say you were understanding these reasons and you were capable of assessing them as when they were reasons for making this prediction or not. Now you can just, if you really are in that position, then you can just put aside the fact that it was a prediction of the oracle and just concentrate on those reasons. Do those reasons support the claim being made? And I think that's the situation we are with respect to science. We have the science, and we can't do any better than to look at the science and to decide whether the scientific reasons themselves are good or not. Okay. So if the PMI is going to be a good argument, then it had better do two things. It needs to be able to argue the notion of science or scientific theory is one that it's appropriate to do with induction on. It's not a family resemblance concept. It's not a disjunctive concept. There is something in science that allows for this induction. And it's got to be that the pessimistic meta-induction in some way is able to give us a reason for doubting the cogency of the scientific inferences themselves. So if the PMI is any good, it should be the case that you think, I look at these scientific reasons, I look at the scientific arguments, and I think they're pretty good, but the PMI makes me suddenly downgrade the epistemic weight I'm willing to put on them. I thought this was a really good argument, but in the light of the PMI, I'm going to think that's not such a good argument. It has to be able to do that. Okay. So, what kinds of reasons might you have for thinking that we can satisfy those two requirements? Well, one is you might think that science is unified by this thing, the scientific method. So the scientific method is a bit like, on this view, is a bit like a factory making cars. It makes cars that are okay, they run for a while, but some fault in the manufacturing process, or perhaps it's built in obsolescence. If something bad in the manufacturing process means that these cars will break down, in due course, before their time. Science is unified by the scientific method, and it's some flaw in the scientific method that explains why the PMI holds the science in general. I mean, you might go for something more general, like, you know, scientific inference is amplitude.
That's really, yeah, that's problematic. Amplitude inferences are going to be particularly liable to this kind of problem. And the third kind of argument is a sort of specific version of the PMI, which says that
what's going on in a lot of science is, something we're really interested in is inference to the best explanation. And inference to the best explanation is problematic because it suffers from this problem, the problem of under consideration, as Peter Lipton calls it, or the problem of unconceived alternatives, as Carl Stanford calls it. So here the idea is that what we in particular notice about these cases of the refutations of past successful theories that are supposed to be the inductive basis for the pessimistic meta-induction is that they are replaced by, the refuted theories are replaced by new theories which hadn't been thought of at the earlier period in history when the initial theory itself was being thought up. So the real problem is supposed to be we're just not very good at scanning the range of possible explanations. That we think up new explanations as an ad hoc, post hoc kind of way, once we find that the previous thing is refuted, rather than are able to scan them in advance. And that Stanford argues is a particular reason why we shouldn't created our current theories, because there's going to be some genuine competitor to them that we hadn't thought of when we were considering the theory and thought it up and favoured it. We will only come across this competitor when our current theory gets refuted and we're forced to think harder about stuff. Okay, so I'm not going to spend too in two tests of time. I won't talk really much about the first two, some brief comments. I don't think there is such a thing as the scientific method. Look, here's one reason. Okay, it's a pessimistic measuring argument, really, I suppose. What is it? We philosophers, science, have been in the business of trying to think up what this method is, and no one's really come up with anything satisfactory. And interesting, there's a nice paper that James Nye published in the BJPS a number of years ago, in which James Blachowicz looked at what scientific textbooks say about scientific method. They can't agree. And in particular, the sorts of things that they emphasise differ quite a lot between the different fields. Biologists, so you might get biology textbooks saying your scientific method underlies all the science, and this is what it is, and it will emphasise features that apply to biology, stuff about causal mechanisms and the rest of it, that when you read the physics textbooks are absent, something else is in their place, and when you read the psychology or medical literature, they all say different things about what the method is, scientific method is. And even then, it's not really a method. It's some sort of general sort of precepts rather than anything that that were, if you were to take it, you could apply and do science. So in a sense, it counts of scientific method are disunified, and they're not counts of anything like a method that, as it were, is what drives science and could explain its success when it's successful, but would also explain its failures when it fails, according to the PMI. The real problem with the second is that it would just prove too much. We use amplitude inferences all the time, arguably. And we wouldn't have ended up here all in the same room if we were genuinely sceptical or had reason to be sceptical, generally got things wrong with amplitude inferences. So I think that there are the philosophical questions,
surrounding the nature of amplitude, but there's a serious explanation of why the PMI holds. I don't think that that's, if it holds at all, or would hold, I don't think that's particularly helpful. The under consideration of thing, I think, is possibly the best argument. But I think this, there are two things to say here. One is just to remind you, I think, that what I was saying earlier about Ludwig Feuerbach's rejection of the PMI on the basis of the inductive basis just isn't there in modern science is worth remembering. It's not as if we come across this problem again and again and again in contemporary science. But I have some sympathy for the argument applied in some areas. Yeah. So if we were to think about fundamental physics, I think it seems to me entirely plausible that in 50 years' time, our picture of what the way the fundamental features of the world are, as told by fundamental, near fundamental theories in physics, might be very, very different in certain key respects. Yeah, that seems entirely plausible to me. Do I think fundamental ideas in evolutionary biology are going to look very, very different in the same way? No, I don't. They're going to be interesting advances in physiology and different areas. But I think that when you're doing some particular some bits of science in bits of neuroscience or cellular biology or areas of geology or whatever, the thought that in these quite specific areas working on particular topics, that for all of these areas they suffer from a problem of under consideration, it just doesn't seem to me to be plausible. These areas just are different. They suffer from different kinds of obstacle to getting things right in those areas, and in different areas people may be able to overcome those problems. But under consideration seems to be more of a problem in some areas than in others. I want to say something else. One thing I ought to say again on this point is, am I not admitting that inference of the best explanation is, in a sense, something that unifies, if not all of science, at least many interesting bits of science, the most sort of theoretically heavy-duty bits of science, by even sort of contemplating this. I think inference of the best explanation, again, it's one of these things where we can say something quite general, such that inference of the best explanation, this broad pattern of inference, is very common across science. But does that mean there is one, it is a single pattern of inference, as it were, it is used repeatedly in such a way that it might, perhaps in conjunction with this problem, be an explanation of why there is some success in science, but it is limited, that even successful theories are refuted eventually. I think that inference of best explanation is not the same throughout science, and that's because what counts as best is different in different bits of science. In bits of physics, what might make a theory look really good is that it has a small number of axioms that are syntactically simple, have a certain kind of theoretical elegance there, whereas in other areas of science, not even expressed in terms of mathematical axioms. So that kind of elegance and simplicity simply won't apply. But it would be a matter about the kinds, sense of what's a good theory in cytology. It might well be it's a matter of what the causal mechanisms look like.
my general feeling about this is that our sense of good explanation, what counts as a good explanation in an area of science, is not some a priori notion of goodness, but is rather acquired from our experience in that particular field. Yes, the successful theories in that field are what generates a sense of what a nice theory looks like. So here, my favourite example of this is, why did people think that Coulomb's posed law of electrostatic attraction was a nice theory? Well, the main reason why was not that it had some super duper data set that you picked that his law out. On the contrary, although he did a nice torsion beam experiment, yeah, the data were pretty ropey, frankly. People were just impressed by that. Look, it's an inverse square law. It looks just like Newton's law of gravitation with the minus sign in front. Okay. Isn't that cool? Isn't that lovely, right? That was strongly motivating. That was a note that it is by comparison with earlier successful theories that we get our notion of what a nice theory in this field looks like. But if that's correct, then we wouldn't expect notions of goodness and therefore bestness to be the same throughout science. Okay. So I don't think there is any global pessimistic meta-induction. I do think there can be some local ones. This is important. So the areas I'm particularly interested in, social psychology and clinical medicine, areas that use null hypothesis significance testing. I think the fact that we've got this replication crisis is a local reason for thinking that the very specific methods that we use in those fields are problematic. Okay. But that's because we can identify a very specific method that is used. And we can talk about what its particular weaknesses are. We can't generalize that to all of science because other bits of science don't use that method. Or if they do use it, they have much larger data sets that just mean the problems that are local to psychology and medicine don't arise elsewhere. Okay. So let's quickly, we've got some time here.
10 minutes.
Yeah, that'll be fine. The more souped-up version of the no miracles argument that we get from Stathis and from Richard Boyd. So here the idea is that our subjects, we focus on the fact that our scientific theories are given to us by methodology that is highly theory-informed and theory-laden. So we have successful theories, but what it is that this argument tends to do is not to tell us, and therefore those theories are good and true, but rather that the theories that are embedded in the methodology that gave us those theories, those are the ones that we should think must be true. Why do they want to do that? One is that I think they think that this is a way of addressing the instrumentalist challenge from people like Van Fransen. That if we go to the methodology, it's arguably more difficult. But I'm not sure I agree, to claim that all we should be inferring is the empirical adequacy of those theories. But I think that's part of what's going on. You have to go talk about the methodology. The methodology is good at producing instrumentally acceptable theories, but that's because the methodology must be getting things right, and therefore the theories in it must be true rather than merely empirically adequate. But I'm not quite sure whether that argument works. The other reason that I think is, as it were, you can think of the
theories and the methodologies have been better empirically supported. You know, they have whatever empirical support they got when they were, as it were, the sort of cutting edge theories, and now they've become accepted and embedded into our methodology, they get support from the fact that they produce other theories that are successful.
But anyway, if this, so here is, on this count, the explanandum, the reliability of science in producing correct predictions. The best explanation is our background. The background theories in our methodology are true. Then we note that these background theories were produced by inference of the best explanation, and therefore inference of the best explanation
is generally reliable.
Okay, so what do I think about that? Okay, so I preempted the argument, just to save time, preempted the argument here, okay. So if that previous argument is correct, where the general reliability of inference of the best explanation is part of an explanation of the reliability of science or scientific methodology, then we're assuming a unity to inference of the best explanation that for the reasons I've already given, I just don't think it has. Okay, so the parallel with the PMI, but I think the parallel is that the both assume a unity that simply doesn't exist. Okay, so some of what I've, this is the conclusion, some of what I'm saying is similar to what Magnus and Callender have to say in their discussion of retail and wholesale arguments. The terminology I've been using is of sort of local and global and first order and second order. And we could talk about what the similarities and differences are, but what I've been arguing here is that, second order meta scientific, that you've been saying, I don't think there are any good meta scientific global arguments. I mean, the best, so in the simple version of the miracles argument, yeah, the second order or meta-scientific arguments really just order reduced to the first order scientific arguments you see in the scientific journals and scientific papers. We can get some local meta-scientific arguments going if we find that in a particular area that there is unexpected failures of our theories, more than we were expecting given our first order arguments. And as I say, I think that some areas that I'm interested in, clinical medicine and social psychology, suffer from exactly that problem. But that's going to be local arguments. Okay, so one way of thinking about this is, if you had these global arguments, the scientist, some particular scientist is, in fact, all scientists, any scientist has a degree of belief in her theory, based on her evidence and reasons, and then the NMA comes along and says, "Hey, science is great. Boost your credences." And the pessimistic meta-reductionist comes along and says, no, you downgrade your credences. But it doesn't really make sense to do that. If you think about science as a whole, how can that be? Neither of these arguments has adduced any more evidence than we had the scientist and all her colleagues has in the first place. There's no more evidence than they already have. Locally, perhaps, but not globally. Okay. Possibly if there's a unified scientific method, we might get some kind of argument going, but I don't think we do. Let's just move on quickly to finish. So where does this leave the realism, anti-realism debate?
Well, I think it means that we've been wasting our time, really. Unless you're doing arguments of this kind of local to a particular area of science, I don't think there's anything to be said. But I will give you, I think, the nearest argument, I think, to the no miracle. This might be what some people pushing the no miracles argument are trying to say. Okay, so I'll see what you think about this. Because I think what part of the problem here is that we've been trying to do philosophy, as philosophers, somehow we can bypass all this rather nitty-gritty, difficult science stuff. We can, by being philosophers, we could just simply put that on one side and give you some fancy historical, kind of philosophical argument as to why science is great or why science is rubbish. But you can't. I'm going to say, so you can't bypass all the science. That's sort of irritating for us, because it might mean there's little else for us philosophers to do. And after all, it's difficult to understand all that difficult science stuff. I think some people in this room probably can, but philosophers more generally might not be able to do that. But I think that there is a sense in which there's a frustration. So for instance, you're confronted by people who are, you say, I hear that there are all these people who hear all the stuff about the climate, but then there's other scientists there who say that there's something dodgy there about all this climate science or about vaccines and the rest of it. I don't know, because I'm not a scientist, how am I supposed to make my mind up? Perhaps I should just be with. Yeah, and people say, but no, science is great to believe. Yeah, when climate scientists say you've got a problem, you should believe them. And we want to have something to offer these people. I'm sort of saying, actually, really, it's very difficult to do that. But here's the closest you might get. So look, you might say something like, this is an MA argument of a kind. Science-based technology is obviously very successful. Okay, that's... So the scientists behind this technology are not charlatans. They genuinely understand a lot of difficult science. Okay, we can agree on that. So we can trust what these scientists say in particular. If they say that they have evidence for a certain theory, and that's overwhelming evidence in its favor, then we should be willing to accept what those scientists say. The ones that, the science behind the computer. Then what we say is, although I don't think there's a methodological unity of science, it is nonetheless the case that the various fields of science are interlinked, for example, through interdisciplinary collaboration. So the broad norms of science, respect for truth, tentativeness about cutting-edge theories, willingness to follow where the evidence leads, and to question orthodoxy if need be, are common to all scientists. Consequently, we should extend the trust afforded to applied scientists, those behind the technology, to pure scientists. And so we should be willing to believe their theories because we trust them, and believe the theories that they hold to be overwhelmingly supported by the evidence. That is the best I think I can do on behalf of the no-miracles argument. But I shall stop now because of that.